Well, with the recent price break you're catching at the gas pump, it might last for a while. And according to the Energy Information Administration, the worsening economy continues to hammer energy commodities such as crude oil and natural gas, driving down the cost of driving cars and heating our homes. Well, that's good for the short term. But what about the long term? In a moment, David Bloom joins us. Alcohol can be a gas. David Bloom is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. He's the leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. Alcohol Can Be a Gas is providing people everywhere with an unrivaled and informative look at how alcohol fuel is being used around the world to combat climate change as well as to solve energy and food shortages while creating new employment opportunities. Well, we need that. David, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Well, I'm always glad to be here, George.
My pleasure. I had an expert on the program who has been looking at this economic disaster we are in right now, and he said the one thing that this new administration can do when it takes over in January is to create an initiative of alternative fuel and to do it in a big way to turn the economy around. Would you agree with that?
Well, wholeheartedly. A whole lot of what's going on today has been certainly, if not caused, inflamed by the draining of capital out of all the world's economies to pay for oil. So alternative fuels, ones made from the sun, like alcohol or any number of our alternatives to fossil fuels, stems that hemorrhage of capital out of our country. And boy, do we need to get a hold of some capital to get things going.
Absolutely. Now, for those who didn't hear you when you were on the show, the first time with me, give me a quick overview and a rundown on what alcohol is and how it's used and made as fuel for cars.
Well, the idea of alcohol, which is, of course, the same thing as moonshine, is that it has always been the best fuel for cars and has been around even before gasoline was ever invented. In fact, most cars used to run on it. So it's kind of an aberration that nowadays we're running on gasoline when alcohol has always been really the best fuel for internal combustion engines. And the way we make alcohol is pretty much done for us by plants. In other words, plants take solar energy. They mix it with carbon dioxide from the air and water and make carbohydrates like starches and sugars. We go ahead and ferment those, just like making, say, wine or beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then when that part of it's done, we've got, say, 13% wine made out of corn or whatever we're using, as a good crop for making energy. We then distill it. And once we've got 190 proof to 200 proof alcohol, that's all we need to run our cars. No gasoline needed at all.
And it's cleaner, isn't it?
Well, it's about 98% cleaner than gasoline. So it's almost pollution-free, pretty darn close. But more important than that, other than pollution, is this whole greenhouse gas issue. Alcohol fuel production actually reverses global warming because plants take out a lot more CO2 out of the atmosphere to make alcohol than is released when we go ahead and burn it in the car. So if we crank up photosynthesis, crank up plant growing, whether it's marine algae or land plants, we're going to be drawing down the CO2 that's causing all the problems.
What's going on with the supply of oil around the world these days? Prices are plummeting. I mean plummeting now, and though I'd like to see them drop even more at the tank, what's happening here with this demand?
Well, there's a lot of things going on and a lot of chaff being thrown in the air that's, out there to keep us confused about the situation. Part of it is completely predictable, and I wrote about this 2 years ago, and I've pointed out that the last 10 elections or so, there's always a drop in the price of oil before the election, and then shortly after the election, it cranks back up, and by March of the following year, it's up as high or higher than it was before it dropped. That pattern's the same this year. We're going to see, a couple more weeks probably of low prices, but it won't last for very long because basically this is always done as a favor buying exercise by the oil companies with whoever's running for office. Now, in the case of the Bush administration in the last election, the midterm election, the price of oil literally started back up the next day after the election on November 7th. So it's going to take a little longer into this administration because, of course, big oil doesn't want to be right in the crosshairs of the first legislation of the new, of this new administration. So what we'll see is probably something like a refinery explosion or perhaps blaming it on a cold snap and heating oil suddenly being in demand. But you'll see price start to spike within the next, well, before Christmas. Goldman Sachs.
So some event, you think, will create this push?
Well, some of that is, you know, manipulated and just waiting for an opportunity. Goldman
right,
Sachs
look
is
it,
looking
sure.
at $150 a barrel oil by January 1st. So lots of other analysts are predicting a little bit longer.
That's based on this economic mess we're in?
Well, it's independent of the economic mess we're in.
Okay. You
know, basically,
I mean, when did they make this prediction?
Well, they're basically looking at the fact that it costs a lot more money nowadays to get oil out of the ground and process it than it did 20 years ago.
Right.
20 years ago, you could process, pull a barrel of oil out of the ground and process it for, you know, maybe $10, $15. But in most of the world now, it's at least $30 or $40. So if you're selling it for $60, you're only making a 20 or 30% profit, you know, in general. And that's not enough. You know, these countries that rely on oil income to pay for everything, you know, completely artificial economies, can't live at this level for very long. So they've already started doing cuts, which is, you know, eventually going to find its way back to the United States. It's mainly causing pain in other countries right now. We're running about 2 million barrels a day short at
yeah.
this point, you know, less than the world actually needs.
Now, you mean short in terms of production?
That's right.
Okay.
In other words, somebody is not getting their oil. So, you know, generally this is rotated around the third world, but it can actually creep its way into the United States. So you find, you know, places like Ghana or Cameroon or Gabon, you know, these places find that they don't get all the oil they ordered. And so they have to, like, make do with whatever they get. But the oil companies are pretty good about not angering the industrialized countries unless they get a really juicy opportunity. And you and I, you know, broke that story just a few weeks ago when the oil companies took advantage of the hurricanes in the Gulf, and then they made it our turn to be short of oil. So basically we were looking at, you know, Georgia and North Carolina and Tennessee having scenes right out of Mad Max where, you know, police cars were escorting gasoline tankers to gas stations to fill them up and then having to wait while the people, you know, emptied all the gasoline out of the station because the line would be 2 or 3 miles long and people would be, you know, fighting in line to, you know, get their gas to get to work, or teachers would be not able to get to school because they couldn't buy gas, or news agencies for television would go on the air saying, well, we'd like to bring you the news tonight, but we couldn't get gas for our van, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the rest of the country didn't even know it was happening. It was mostly, you know, kept bottled up in the southeast. When gas prices were dropping in the rest of the country, it was going to $4.85 in the south. So, you know, the days of shortage or rationing, you know, aren't in the future. They just happened to us, you know, just a few weeks ago. You know, the author of The Long Emergency, Kunstler, came out with a missive the other day saying, you know, this is completely bogus. The low price of fuel right now is completely fabricated because, as you mentioned, George, the Energy Information Agency is saying, hey, our best estimates now are much worse than we thought. We're going to be going down 9% a year in production from now on. And what Kunstler says is, what are we looking at? Either a leg back up in oil prices, shortages, hoarding, or rationing. Your choice, what comes next?
And you know what's disappointing, I'm sure, for the automobile industry, David, is now that prices for gasoline are coming down to a manageable level short term, sales for cars have plummeted. And you would have thought that had the price gone down, the sales would have gone up. But this economy, nobody's going to buy anyway.
People are pretty scared right now. You know, they've had their pocketbook drained all summer by high gas prices. And then, of course, all the disaster that's happened. It was interesting for me because I was watching it from the outside when everything hit the fan on the economic front. I was in New Zealand doing a series of talks with the government and with the public there about alcohol fuel. And people were telling me there in the government, well, we may have to keep you down here, Dave. Looks like the airlines are going to collapse. You won't be able to get home.
Jeez.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting watching it from the outside melt down over the 2 weeks that I was gone and watching the rest of the world react to basically a whole lot of the capital of the world evaporating overnight and what that meant. So it really stimulated the interest of everyone in New Zealand when I was there, because they had been relatively comfortable, you know, over time, basically a first world country. And all of a sudden they were looking at themselves being at the very longest end of the tanker route. Like, you know, if anybody's going to get shorted, I mean, they're just like one step from Antarctica. They're pretty far away from where there's any oil. So suddenly everybody was talking about alcohol. And by the time I left, government task forces were forming to see about converting over.
Tonight we're going to talk about the different forms of fuel, alcohol, of course, compressed air with David Bloom. And also we'll tell you how, if you want to make your own alcohol fuel, how you can do that a little bit later on in the program. Diesel fuel, still higher than gasoline. How come?
Well, you know, basically the good oil is gone. So the amount of diesel that you get out of a barrel is a lot less than it used to be. So it used to be the other way around. You got a pretty good amount of diesel and you had less gasoline left over. Diesel is something you actually have to, you know, put some effort into to get out of gasoline or out of oil. But gasoline is whatever's left over after refining. So it can vary all over the place. And in fact, on any given day, there's maybe 400 different chemicals in gasoline, whatever's left over from making diesel or pesticides or linoleum or lipstick or whatever. Whatever's left over is thrown together in gasoline, and it's really the toxic waste of the refining industry. So we get to pay for the privilege of disposing of their toxic waste.
What about heating oil?
Oh, watch out for that. You know, heating oil is such a touchy subject.
They're talking about a severe winter this year.
Yeah, it's coming. And the thing about heating oil is that you can decide not to drive to the movie theater or not to go out to dinner, you know, and burn gasoline to get there. But you can't turn off your heater in most of the country in the winter. You have to buy that fuel. So, you know, even though gas is down a bit right now, and so is heating oil, it's not, it wouldn't take much of a bump at all for people to be paying more for heating oil than they are for their mortgage. And right now, you know, they're getting a little bit of a break. So tank up while you can, because basically in a couple, 3 weeks, you can expect it to really ratchet up.
And it's going to catch up to where it's been then.
Well, it'll take probably all the way to March to catch up to the $4 plus mark that we experienced this summer. But there can be some surprises in that. You know, all it takes is a couple of unexpected disasters in the oil industry, a pipeline going down, a refinery, a true refinery explosion versus one that's fabricated. And all of a sudden, you know, you're pinched for supply and they got the perfect excuse to crank up the price. Now, you know, they can modify that, but they're not likely to, because they've been, you know, shorting themselves now for a couple, 3 months. And boy, I'll tell you, when you're running $150 a barrel, you get kind of used to that when you're an OPEC giant.
That's true. Now, David, when you make alcohol fuel, give me all the various possible ingredients that you can make it from.
Well, gosh, you know, we have such a wide variety of choices. Anything with sugar or starch can be made into alcohol. So a lot of discussion goes into corn because that's what we have a lot of. But it's not a very good energy crop, maybe 300 gallons per acre, usually about 250. So we're talking right now with basically a faith-based organization that works with farmers in the South. And they're talking about a lot of these impoverished farmers switching over to growing, say, sweet sorghum, which produces over 1,000 gallons an acre. And sweet sorghum's the source for making blackstrap molasses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Looks like sugar cane, but it grows here where it's colder.
Do you get a double dip out of what you plant? You can use some of it for one thing and the rest for fuel, or does it all have to go to fuel, for example?
Well, actually, we get more like a triple or quadruple dip out of it if we do it the way we talk about it in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. Because, you know, the press talks about diverting corn into alcohol plants as if the corn somehow is completely destroyed and it's used for fuel and there's nothing left. But remember, we just said what alcohol is made from, which is carbohydrate. So everything that's nutritious in the corn, the protein, the fat, the other nutrients, they're all still there when you're done making the alcohol. They're in the mash. And when you go ahead and, you know, go ahead and spin the water out of that mash and you go ahead and dry it, you can then sell what looks just like the original grain, but now it's without the starch. It's got all the essential ingredients. So since almost all of our corn goes for animal feed, we end up using the mash or the dried distiller's grains as animal feed, and we actually don't see any loss in value. In other words, or in essence, cattle actually can't even hardly digest the starch. So we're really taking what's usually going to waste, the starch that's in the corn, making it into alcohol, and making better animal feed. You know, one of my favorite stories is the way revenuers used to find who was moonshining in a given county, is they go to the county fair and they see who had the fattest hogs and the biggest cattle. And they knew those guys had stills and they were feeding the byproducts to their animals because farmers can't help but brag, you know. So that's how they would get caught for having stills. So it's something we've known about for 100 years. And the dairy industry practically fights over the stuff that produces so much milk.
That's interesting. Truly is. You know, tonight, when we get into how you can make it yourself, do you recommend that, or should we just go to some kind of manufacturing distiller place?
Well, you know, because I'm an ecologist by training, it really bothers me when anything goes to waste. So what I'm always in favor of is making sure that we squeeze all the good stuff out of whatever it is we make into energy. And, you know, actually, this is a really good way to do business. So if you have something that's left over, the point is make some more money from what that is and don't treat it as a waste product, which is a cost then to your operation. So if we were like throwing away this byproduct instead of using it for something else, that would actually make alcohol more expensive. Now, normally that's how things are done in America. You make something, you throw everything away. But using the byproducts as a valuable input for other products actually can make you more money. Alcohol is pretty cheap as a product. The byproducts from alcohol fuel, the way we talk about it in the book, can be enormously more valuable than the alcohol itself. For instance, if you're making, say, 10,000 gallons of alcohol a year, and that's worth maybe $25,000, the byproducts from making that much alcohol could be worth $400,000. So, you know, it's kind of like you turn it on its head. It's like the alcohol is the byproduct, and all these so-called byproducts are actually the valuable food products that we can make from alcohol, mostly for humans. And that's where we can make the money. And that's where small-scale alcohol plants have a giant advantage over the big ones.
Tell me about your speaking tour in New Zealand. What happened?
Well, boy, that was sure wild. I went down to New Zealand thinking I would talk to a couple of eco groups. And as I was there, you know, word spread because it's a small country, and I was speaking all over the place. And what was going on was really interesting because governments there, basically the equivalent of state governments, regional governments, were holding public forums just with like 2 or 3 days notice. And, you know, 100, 200 people would show up for these things. And it was really refreshing because, you know, in some ways the New Zealanders have not had all the spirit beat out of them like a lot of places right. In the United States. So they were people ready to, you know, get on it right away. And what was really interesting is that there were people who, as kids, remember the alcohol fuel industry that was in New Zealand back when they were quite young. You see, New Zealand never got really any oil until after World War II because there weren't any tankers yet that were delivering down there.
Good
that
point.
All was a result of World War II. So people were talking about sweet sorghum and beets, and I can tell you more about New Zealand when we get a chance to come back after the break.
Thank you for that, David. We'll be back. Peter Joseph, the producer of the two internet sensations, Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist Addendum, joins us on our next Coast to Coast program on Friday, followed by Those Open Lines. Going to talk about all your speaking engagements here, David, but let's finish up on the New Zealand tour.
Well, New Zealand was kind of amazing because there's only you know, 4.3 million people there, which is not a large population.
No, not at all.
But there's an awful lot of cows and sheep, probably 10 for every person that's in New Zealand. So if, as I travel around New Zealand, I was continually being bombarded with, what do we do about non-point source pollution? Well, that's a big term for a lot of manure and urine washing off the countryside into rivers and lakes. Like, the rivers were so fouled with this stuff that even the cattle couldn't drink the water.
Oh, gosh.
So, you know, we sat down and talked about what one of the solutions would be, and it would make sense here and it makes sense there, which is there's a wild plant called cattails, which grows all over New Zealand in any wet spot, and we have them all over the United States. It's kind of, you know, a universal marsh plant. And what's really great about this plant is that it's 60% starch. Now, corn is only 70% starch, so corn grain. So the yield in sewage treatment plants in the United States, where we use these cattails to suck up all the nutrients out of the sewage before the waters let go into rivers or into the ocean, makes these cattails grow like all get out. So instead of 300 gallons per acre, which is what we get from corn, from cattails we get 7,500 gallons per acre. So it's an enormous amount of fuel, and we get to clean up the water and the environment at the same time. So there was a lot of, you know, heavy-duty discussion all throughout with farmers and with the government about instituting, you know, basically fuel marshes that would clean up the countryside's water and clean up the rivers, and at the same time supply the whole country with all the alcohol it would need to be able to, you know, displace all the oil that's going on in the country right now.
Now, you recently addressed the Biotechnology International Organization group in Vancouver. You talked about biofuels. Is there much interest there?
Well, you know, that's a great story, George, because, you know, I got on that kind of because of your show. Someone called up right after I was on with you and said, we got to have you as the keynote speaker at our conference. And I said, that's great. I like to do that. And they said, well, we're the Biotechnology International Organization. And I kind of look at the phone like, this is a joke, right?
Yeah,
I mean, these
exactly.
are the gene splicers. Why are they calling me? I'm not their friend, you know? So I say, you realize if you have me speak, I'll trash all of your sponsors. And the woman said, I don't care. I only work here. The boss said we need to have you. So I said, send the check first, you know? So I go to give the talk. And this is a high-powered situation. All the oil companies are there because this is all about, you know, biofuels and using gene technology and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to give my talk, and I'm up there, and I'm going into this about – I'm into it about 10 minutes or so, and I'm being pretty hard on all the sponsors, you know, because I'm talking about the kind of solution you and I were talking about a minute ago, that real biotech
– sure.
is all about, you know, making multiple uses out of all the byproducts from the process. And that's like smart biotech rather than messing with genes. And in the middle of my talk, the lights go out. Now, this is in a luxury hotel that costs $300 million. It must have 3 backup generators, and the lights go out during my talk. So someone wants me off the stage, right? Well, I don't hesitate for a minute. I just start telling a story. I say, boys and girls, we're here in the dark, so I'm going to tell you a campfire story. And I tell them about when I was on, you know, years ago, I did a 10-part series for PBS on alcohol fuel, 10.5-hour shows, all the whole how-to. It was, you know, the revolution that we wanted to have in 82 to go to alternative fuels. And I got to the part where I said, you know, the reason why that show didn't go very far, it only showed once in San Francisco, is that Chevron went ahead and called PBS and said, well, what's wrong? We don't understand. We thought you liked our money. We don't want to see this on the air. So they canceled the series, and they canceled the printing of my book back in 1982.
Oh, my gosh.
So then I
used a little muscle, did they?
Well, just a little muscle. Well, one of the sponsors of this conference was Chevron. So then I say from the stage, you got to remember, everybody's in the dark, right? You know, listening to me say this, I say, well, the sponsor from Chevron, please get his hand off the light switch. And the lights went back on. But, you know, I'll tell you what was the spooky thing about this, because these guys are talking about some really awful things. Like, for instance, Chevron and Weyerhaeuser were up there saying, Well, here's our plan. We're going to take the forests of the Southeast, and we're going to make synthetic fuel from it. And everybody's waiting to say, oh, yes, cellulosic ethanol, you know, because that's what's all in the press. And they said, oh, no, we're not going to make cellulosic ethanol because we'd get the same tax credit as the alcohol guys if we make synthetic gasoline out of trees. We don't think that there should be an alternative on the market because that's inconvenient. We should just stick with gasoline, and we'll make artificial gasoline out of the woods of the Southeast, and Weyerhaeuser and Chevron are working together on this. So that was creepy. And then DuPont gets up there and says, well, we've got a process where we're going to make, you know, alcohol first, but then we're going to convert it into synthetic fuel for gasoline diesel engines. And Honeywell gets up there and says the same thing. So these guys are all talking about turning cellulose or plant matter into synthetic gasoline instead of alcohol, just because if you do it that way, then you don't let the farmers in on the deal. In other words, they can't make synthetic gasoline. These are all patented processes, but they sure can make alcohol. So I got up and addressed the panel from the audience, and I said to them, you know, it sounds to me like your plan is to try to convince farmers to grow, you know, plant fiber for you, you know, grass for $250 per acre per year. And that's like every farmer knows that the last thing you do before you go broke is grow grass. You know, what we're talking about with alcohol fuel is farmers making $5,000 or $10,000 an acre growing sorghum or beets or Jerusalem artichokes.
And that's huge money for them.
And that's like good money. So I said, you guys up there, you know, you guys, you know, on the stage, you have a problem with your business plan. And it sounds to me like you're declaring war on the farmers. So I got to tell you, we're going to declare war on you. And I walk away from the microphone. So, you know, basically people came to me from all kinds of other countries who were at this conference saying, well, the big guys just told us they don't need us, they don't want us, and we have all these labs, and we can, you know, we want to do what you're doing. It's a lot more fun talking about what you're doing, which is taking corn and making alcohol and then taking the byproduct and feeding it to fish. And then taking the byproduct from the fish, all the fish water manure, and using that to go ahead and grow vegetables. You know, in other words, that kind of biotech where we make use of everything in the process. They all said, oh, that's what we'd much rather do than splicing genes. Let's, you know, have you come to Russia. Let's go do this there, you know, and, you know, forget these guys in the U.S. And the guys in New Zealand, you know, gosh, they were saying, oh, you don't have an institute or land in the U.S. yet? Well, we'll give you 100 acres of citizenship, no problem. So it's like, you guys are going to lose me here in the United States if we don't find land and some money for me to stick around here.
Do we have processing plants for alcohol?
Oh, yeah. We got about 124 of them, I think, all over mostly the Midwest, but there's also some in other places.
Big ones for enough capacity, or would we really, if we really kick this up, we need to build some, right?
We need to, but you know, George, what I talk about in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, is big is not better. What we need is a lot of small plants all over the country that are operated by, well, people like you or I. You know, it's, gosh, it's not rocket science to make moonshine. We've been making it, well, it's mankind's second oldest profession. We know how to do this, you know. So what we really ought to be doing is talking about small plants in every county in the United States instead of great big giant plants, because the big plants, they're vulnerable. Right now, a lot of big plants are close to going bankrupt because the oil companies have been manipulating the price of corn over the last year and a half.
Now, how have they done that?
Well, it's actually pretty simple, you know, and in my book, I talk about why you got to stop them from gaming corn before they actually did it, and that you should, you know, put controls on the futures market, because what they do is go out and buy corn futures at a high price. That means the alcohol guys have to pay a lot for the corn. Well, of course, that cuts into whatever profit they're going to make. And at the same time, the oil companies control the futures market for the alcohol because they buy it to blend with gasoline. So they put the farmers and the, you know, who own these plants and the companies that own these plants in a nutcracker over the last year and a half. And then they blamed alcohol for the price of corn going up. Well, it turns out that there's a whole investigation going into that right now, and they're discovering that, as someone put it, the oil companies had their thumb on the scale. So they'd buy these corn contracts at a high price, and then they'd sell them off to their buddies at General Mills or Kellogg or whatever at a low price and take the loss so that alcohol plants would be put in a bad position. They could afford to do that because they made, what, $124 billion last year. Losing a couple of billion to put the competition out of business is like, well, that's not even a conspiracy. That's just business as usual. So, you know, readers of the book have been writing to their congresspeople saying, investigate the commodities futures trading. And, you know, and they have. And in the, as soon as the investigation got going, the price of corn cratered. And it's down to where it was before all the propaganda about food versus fuel. It's down about $3.60 a bushel now, when during the height of the propaganda this summer, it was like at $8. So farmers at this point are saying, whoa, what are we going to do? Because last year, there was no shortage of corn. There was no reason for the price to go up. We had a surplus of 1.6 billion bushels. And they're still sitting in the silos. And it's like, where are we going to put all the corn for this year? And now the price has been cut. So one of the things I'm really afraid about, and I really want people to, if they can, go to our website and check this out.
Which is which one?
Oh, God, here we go, George. Last time we did this, you totally toasted my website.
We're going to do it again.
Here we go. All right, so let's see if we can hold up to you this time.
You also have little ideas on how people can do this themselves, right?
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. So the website, of course, is alcoholcanbeagas.com. And you can find out all about, of course,
B spelled B-E, right?
Yes, just like you'd expect, alcoholcanbeagas.com. And we have a number of things going on the website, but part of what we have going on is we're really trying to build up a huge list of people that can help write when the oil companies do these kind of shenanigans so that we can put pressure on our congresspeople in a grassroots way. So we have incentives right now, if you'll just join our mailing list, so we can send you these notices once in a while when we have to, as a grassroots, you know, group of people, stop the oil companies from what they're doing. So we'd really encourage you to do that.
You don't think, just using corn for an example, if we really divert corn to ethanol on a massive basis, that we're going to cause any starvation around the world, which is, again, what they say?
Well, you know, the first thing they say about that, of course, assumes that there's not enough corn. In other words, if alcohol producers and food producers are competing for corn, then the price goes up. There's a shortage of corn around the world. But as I just said, there was a surplus last year. In the middle of all this propaganda, the reality was not only was there not a shortage, there was a flood of extra corn. So, like, you know, when you talk to a reporter, you say, what part of surplus don't you understand? It's like, how can the price go up when there's a surplus? Because we all know about capitalism. If you have a surplus of something, the price goes down normally. And if there's a shortage, the price goes up. No shortage, the price shouldn't go up. So the other thing that you got to remember is that 90% of our corn is fed to cattle. And as we just talked about a minute ago, taking the starch out has no effect on how much meat we get because cattle can't digest starch. When you feed 10 pounds of corn to a cow, 1 pound becomes meat. Well, that means the other 9 pounds went somewhere, didn't it?
Yep, yep.
It went out the back door. And most of that is starch. So we've been wasting the starch all this time. So here's the funny thing about it, actually. If you feed the byproduct to the cattle instead of the original corn, you actually get 17% more meat. So not only is the product...
And it's safe for the cattle.
Oh, yeah. Farmers have been feeding mash to cattle since they've been moonshining, which is like a few thousand years.
They might have some drunk cattle, but...
And they like that. So, so in other words, the food versus fuel thing has been completely fabricated. And basically, the press has been sucked in, and progressives have been sucked in, and basically repeating the same things over and over. And here we go. The price of corn cuts in half. The same amount of alcohol is being produced. So clearly, alcohol's has no effect on the price of corn or its availability. And yet, you know, if you tell that lie enough times, people start to believe it. So it's one of the things we really explore in the book. And if you go on our website, you can see excerpts from the book where we talk about the food versus fuel issue and, you know, get yourself educated on that. So when somebody says that to you next time, you can point out that that's American Petroleum Institute propaganda, and it has no basis in fact.
This email, and give me your take on this. He said, one of our listeners, the largest crop in the U.S. by weight is grass clippings, which are cellulose. If every county had an alcohol plant turning green waste into cellulose, into alcohol, we would replace a lot of our fuel.
Yeah, you know, I have a chart in the book where I talk about that specifically. It's actually the largest irrigated crop in the United States is lawn. But what's interesting about lawn is we use more fertilizer and other chemicals on our lawns than we do on the whole corn crop. So, you know, the whole issue about the energy that goes into growing crops, it's like you start looking at lawns and it's like, who cares about energy, right? Who's really caring about energy when, you know, chemical-based fertilizers are being used on our lawns? We can replace about 11 to 15% of our total fuel just from our lawns. Processing that instead of sending it to the landfill.
That's pretty dramatic.
Well, it's not just dramatic. It's like what's amazing is how little land that is. You know, it's just a little bit of patches of green around our houses and golf courses, and yet it adds up to 30 million acres where corn, yet this is only 70 million acres.
Oh, my God.
So our lawns are actually a huge amount of acreage, but when you look at the total acreage of the United States that's good for agriculture, we actually only use 5% of our agricultural land for corn. But if you listen to the pundits, you would think that we're using every bit of it for corn and there's no room left for anything else. We have so much land in this country, George, just like New Zealand, where we can go ahead and become an alcohol exporter after replacing all of our transportation fuel with alcohol. And probably start to replace a lot of our coal and nuclear for electricity as well.
You know, venture capital money's not going there. Of course, there's not that much available right now anyway. What are you going to do for money that you need to develop these plants?
Well, you know, it's cheap to develop these plants, though, George. I mean, cheap. And I mean, you take a look at what we've spent lately on everything that's been going on, and alcohol plants are a bargain. In other words, we can build alcohol plants for somewhere in the neighborhood, and this is, you know, small plants, big plants, $1 to $2 a gallon. You know, and $1 is normal. So you want a 10 million gallon per year plant, cost you $10 million. But that permanently, that 10 bucks, you know, that
and when you say $10 million, 10 million what gallon plant for $10 million, are you saying that's what it would produce a year, 10 million gallons?
That's right.
Okay.
So let's look at the whole world supply of fuel. It's a big number. It's 500 billion gallons a year. We think, oh, my God, that's a lot of fuel. So luckily, the math is easy to do. $1 times 500 billion is $500 billion. We could replace every bit of gasoline and diesel in the world permanently. That's the world, not the U.S., for $500 billion. And we would you start thinking about what we've spent that kind of money on. Like, I seem to remember that $780 billion figure that we just shoveled into the hands of the wealthy who made bad investments.
We don't even know where it went or where it's going.
We'll never know where it goes. And so we could have taken that money and we could have permanently replaced the world's supply of fuel, plus had a couple of hundred billion left over to build stations all over the world to sell the stuff that wouldn't even be owned by the oil companies.
See, that's the other thing. David, we'll be back. We're already done with this hour. We'll be back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. If you ever need to email me, it's george@coasttocoastam.com. David's website, alcoholcanbeagas.com.